when they took office before the war in December 22, they had a master plan to weaken the free press in the country, and they are doing it as we speak.
Really?
Yes. Prime Minister Netanyahu did not give an interview in Hebrew, journalist interview in Hebrew, since March 21.
No.
Yes.
All right, new episode of Young and Naive. We are on the road, and who are you?
I'm Anat Saragusti. I'm a journalist by profession. And in the last few years, I ran the press freedom department at the Union of Journalists in the country.
And can you tell us where we are right now?
You are at my tiny apartment in center of Tel Aviv.
Thanks for having us. What do you do at the union? Why is there a union for journalists in Israel?
Oh, why?
Yeah.
Journalists needs to be unionized. I mean, I think every worker should be unionized. I'm pro unions.
Well, I mean, you can have unions at the the press station or the radio station, but you need a union for all journalists?
Yes, because we usually run the collective bargains at media outlets with the union of journalists, with our chapter in each media outlet.
And how's it going? How's the situation, the economic situation for journalists?
Bad, like all other journalists in all over the world, of course. I guess so. I mean, journalists are poor. Salaries are not that high. I mean, except if you're, you know, a big talent or something.
There's a joke in German, like you only are rich as a journalist when you have rich parents. Otherwise, don't expect to make
there
any money.
Go. There you go. You have the answer. Yeah. The situation is not good. I mean, the globally, there is no economic sustainability for media outlets. Unless you work at the public broadcaster, then they're much better, doing much better. Or you, I don't know, you have a very, very rich oligarch behind the media outlet.
Did you work for some oligarchs in your life?
Never.
Why?
First of all, I totally support the public broadcaster. I worked there for several years. I started my career at a very small lefty weekly news magazine, actually founded and edited by a German descent.
Really?
Yes. Uri Avneri. Never heard of him. Google it.
What was the magazine?
It was a weekly news magazine that was doing a lot of investigative journalism, that was really independent, didn't belong to any, you know, party or group of power or rich anybody. You know, it was sustainable. It did a lot of investigative journalism that really shook the country. And we were a very small staff. I began as a photojournalist, and then I started writing. So I was a team of one person who could really, do the pictures and the text as well. It was really very, very efficient for the magazine.
Sure.
That's how I started my career as a local newspaper. You took pictures, so you make money on the pictures, and the text was optional.
Okay, the text was important, but then it was a very, very good school of journalism, because the ethos was that you serve only the public and the public's rights to know, and you are not afraid of anybody, and you don't give any, you don't bend any of your journalist values. For power, you speak truth to the power. We really did that. We were not that popular, but we felt that we have a mission, and we are doing a mission. And then it was shut down because of economic reasons, because the government banned advertising in the magazine. It tried to shut it down. It didn't like it to be so criticism to the government.
Explain how the government can, regulate advertisement in your magazine.
it doesn't regulate, but it avoided subscription to, you know, public workers or soldiers, or, you know, this is part of the business plan of every magazine. It didn't ban advertisement, but it created a climate that, you know, commercial companies did not advertise at the magazine. Eventually, it was shut down. And then I was one of the founders of the first commercial television in the country, which is now Channel 12. It's very, very powerful. It's highly distributed and, yeah. So I was there for many years.
Hey Leute, kurzer Hinweis. Wir stellen ja alles, was wir produzieren, kostenlos ins Netz. Ohne Kommerz. Wir können das nur, weil ihr unsere finanziellen Supporter seid. Das funktioniert seit Jahren und so soll es bleiben. Jeder Euro zählt, per Überweisung oder PayPal. Schaut einfach in die Podcast-Beschreibung und jetzt geht's weiter.
When did the magazine shut down? Like, I never heard of it.
Oh, wow. This was 92, 93 years ago.
Like, I read you were the first Israeli journalist who interviewed Yasser Arafat in Lebanon, right? Yeah. Can you tell us the story, how you got that interview and how important was it in the Israeli public?
Well, Yasser Arafat was then the head of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. There was a, you know, invasion of the Israeli army to Lebanon. This was 1982. They occupied all southern Lebanon pretty much like they do now. You know, this is the third time already. But they reached Beirut, the capital of Lebanon. And they wanted to kick out all the Palestinians, or the headquarters of the Palestinians, or the headquarters of the PLO, who were located in Beirut. So they put a lot of pressure, and we reached Beirut as journalists, and I pushed my editor, who was then with me at Beirut, to use his contacts and so we can get to the other side of the conflict lines and get to see what's going on there. You know, there were under siege and there was shortage of water and electricity and food and stuff like that. And I thought this was, the story is there.
Yeah.
You know, so we did that and we crossed the conflict lines. It was scary. We had to cross, you know, all kinds of roadblocks and checkpoints. Because there were many different armies there. There was the Syrians and the Lebanese army and the Christian army and then the PLO army, the Israeli army, of course. We had to cross all these checkpoints, which we did. And so it happened that we interviewed Arafat.
Did nobody from the Israeli journalist side try to get Arafat before, or did you get lucky? How did you manage to convince him?
Nobody tried before. I don't know if he would agree, because the editor of the magazine was also, for times, a member of the Knesset, of the Israeli parliament. So he was a politician who was, I mean, his agenda was to support the two-state solution, the recognition of the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people, et cetera, et cetera. So he was known for his, you know, standings. So maybe it was easier for Arafat to give him the interview, to give us the interview than anybody else. But I don't know. I don't think that anybody tried before us. I mean, to cross the conflict lines, uh-huh. This is not something that every journalist does. I mean, I think every journalist should try to do that. But usually journalists don't do that.
Well, listen to the other side, right?
Of course. I think it's something that you have to do routinely. Mm-hmm. But during times of war in Israel, because everybody, it's mandatory for everybody to serve in the army, men and women.
You served as well?
Yes. And at times like you know, when there is a high security intention, people tend to be, I don't know, patriotics. Mm-hmm. So they tend to rally around the flag, and they tend not to be too criticizing the government or the policies of the government. The public is not open for criticism at times of war. Everybody knows, sometimes the journalists themselves serves as reservists in the army, mm-hmm. which is a problem. Mm-hmm. And if not that, everybody knows somebody who is now in combat, you know, whether it's your neighbor or your cousin or your father or your son or your brother or whatever. I mean, because everybody is engaged in that. So it really is, the dilemma is, what are you first? Are you first a patriot for Israel and you want your kind of team to win the war? Or are you first an independent journalist who serves the interest of the public?
I mean, as you explained before, like, I think the journalism you described is like res publica, you know, in service of the public and not in service of your country or your government. And maybe you can be both. Maybe in private, when you not work as journalist, you can, you know, be patriotic and hope your team wins. But as a journalist, you shouldn't be like this.
I agree. But I'm a minority who think like that. And I always, you know, at times of conflict, I saw myself first as a journalist who owes to do my work to the public.
But now you're the head of the union.
I'm not the head of the union. Oh. I'm head of the press freedom department at the union.
Okay. But since you're the head of the press freedom department, can't you make sure that more journalists in Israel and everywhere else, you know, adapt this kind of journalism? Because I agree.
Can you force a journalist to do something? No, no, you can't. I mean, every journalist has an editor, and the editor has to demand what the editor has to demand. I have no power on the content of the editorial, you know.
You can have good arguments or the better arguments.
Of course. So I write about it, I talk about it, I criticize them, I post about it. You know, I wrote actually an article on October 16th. Less than 10 days into, you know, the October 7th war, arguing that there is a one-sided war. If you look at the coverage mm-hmm. of the war, it's a one-sided war, as if there is only one side fighting, and because you didn't see the Palestinians at all. So I write a lot about it. I speak a lot about it. But this is all I can do. I don't have, you know, power.
But it sounds like it hasn't much changed in the last 50 years.
Well, this war is...
In times of war.
Yes, but the other wars and the military campaigns were much, much shorter. So towards the end of this, you know, the longest one was in 2014 in Gaza. It lasted 51 or 52 days. So towards the end of this military campaign, they started to show a little bit what's going on the other side of the conflict lines among the Palestinians. But this war, first of all, the intensity of the war, the magnitude of the events, the fact that the majority of the Israelis are traumatized by the October 7th massacre. It really is, you know, it's overwhelming emotionally for most of us. I mean, one of my best friends was murdered on October 7th in one of the kibbutzim. And she was a peace activist, very, you know, intensive peace activist and known for that. Mm-hmm. So it really is a very deep dilemma. How you can distance yourself from your own emotions and, you know, put the hat of the impartial journalist and do your job for the interest of the public. Haaretz newspaper did that from day one. They were the only ones as mainstream media outlet that covered what's happening in Gaza on both all sides. I mean, this is, I see it as the role of the journalist, you know, to cover the 360 degrees of the reality on the ground and not to cover only, you know, one angle. In addition, the only way, since October 7th, there is no foreign press in Gaza. The only way to cover Gaza was under the umbrella of the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson.
From the Israeli side. Of course, there are some Palestinians.
Israeli side.
Yeah.
He was the one to decide who gets in, for how long, and they were embedded into units, and he would decide which unit and who can be interviewed. And they had to sign a waiver, so they give him the power to watch the footage.
And censor it.
And then there is another layer of military censorship who could also, you know, censor part of the footage. So it really filtered. And the IDF spokesperson could filter and create a narrative. On the other side were Palestinian journalists who really were risking their lives, literally risking their lives. More than 200 of them were killed. And they were under threat. I don't know if they could get everywhere. I followed a few, you know, Instagram bloggers and to see the picture, to see what's going on. So usually the wars were shorter and then you could get back to normal. Now you can't get back to normal, and Israel still bans the ability of foreign press to get into Gaza. And so
why do you think that is?
I think they don't want anybody to see what's going on. I mean, people know what's going on there. We've seen satellite photos. We've listened to evidence, to, you know, testimonies. People went there. People speak about there. There are Palestinians who are willing to show what's going on there. But it's easier for Israel to say that they are not reliable because they are under the control of Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
So not everything they say is the whole truth, and sometimes Hamas controls narrative and, you know, things like that. When an independent journalist for CNN, BBC, German television would go in, they will not be able to say, you know, that it's false and fake and manipulated.
I was thinking about, like, if the argument is, okay, the Palestinian journalists, they only show propaganda from the Hamas point of view, why not let in, you know, foreign media to counteract those claims?
Yes. Actually, the Foreign Press Association in Israel filed a petition to the High Court of Justice, mm-hmm. and we at the union joined them as amicus of the court, mm-hmm. saying exactly that, you know, you should let the journalist in, because this is the only way to show the truth. Because journalists know how to collect evidence, they know how to interview people, they know how to weigh, you know, truth against false and then fake, etc. This is the profession.
Mm-hmm.
But until now, they denied it. They declined every attempt. I don't know. I don't know when eventually, you know, people would go in and see the magnitude of the destructions and, you know, the death toll.
Does an Israeli journalist have any choice? Like, if they want to go to Gaza, like, they have to go with the IDF?
Only.
And then they have to agree to be censored?
Yes.
Also, is there no other choice?
Only one choice. Also foreign press,
right.
Coming from Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no access to foreign press unless, you know, under the umbrella of the IDF spokesperson. And these are the conditions. I think that in the last few months, nobody can get into Gaza, journalists. I didn't see any footage from coming from the IDF.
And like Israeli journalists are not fighting it, because like in the entire world, I mean, Israel, you know, is becoming more and more isolated. I mean, let's leave out America and Germany and all this, but like most of the world thinks there's a genocide going on, which is like one of the worst crimes. And Israel says that's not what's happening. And I think like as a journalist, and even if you're patriotic, you know, you want your team to win, then you also want your team not to commit genocide. Why? Like, I don't get why they're not fighting, you know, to counteract this, maybe.
You're right. I don't understand either. But since we represent the majority of the journalists in the country and we joined this petition to the High Court of Justice, it's like the journalists were joining the petition. You know, it's not that they are not oblivious to they didn't stand on their feet, you know, to fight this ban. I didn't see any, you know, comment on television or elsewhere why the IDF, they are not challenging the decision of the IDF not to allow journalists in. Not that I heard of. Maybe they did here and there, but it was not very powerful. They didn't echo it as they could. The definition of genocide is something that Israelis cannot swallow. But by avoiding covering what's going on the other side of the conflict line, the Israeli press is cultivating or helping the narrative as if all the demonstrations against the policies of the State of Israel is anti-Semitism. But this is not the case. Not all the demonstrations against Israel is anti-Semitism. Of course, there is anti-Semitism, and more so. Sure. But when it began, when people in the international community saw the scale of the human toll, children, and destruction in Gaza, and they went out to the streets or put encampments even in the U.S., in the campuses in the U.S., in the university, this was not an act of anti-Semitism. This was an act of criticizing the policies of the State of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians in Gaza, and you know the horrific footage that was pouring into their living rooms all over the world. In Israel, they didn't see any of it, and when they felt like they were forced to show, you know, when there was starvation suddenly in Gaza and children were dying of starvation and malnutrition. They showed it, but they framed it as, look what the world is showing. And they very quickly adopted the narrative dictated by the IDF spokesperson. They had this formula, how many calories a person needs per day, how many trucks are going into Gaza, how many calories are getting into Gaza, divide it by how many people are in Gaza, so they have enough food. I mean, this was a narrative that they very, very quickly adopted. And they didn't want to get into the discussion of a genocide, and this is a pity. All the human rights organizations in Israel define it as a genocide. Many op-eds define it as genocide. Many experts in Israel define it as genocide, but journalists are, you know, distance themselves from this definition.
But like, at some point, we will have like a, you know, a ruling by the ICJ in many years, and the entire world will know. Like, how can they square this? Like, I mean, in 10, 20 years, like, they will look back and be like, oh my God, we could have done something. We could have, you know, reported the truth.
I guess that will happen in the future. Usually it happens faster than that or sooner. But as I told you, the war is still active. I mean, all fronts in Lebanon, in Gaza, with Iran, with the Houthis in Yemen. You know, we have a lot of, and of course, the West Bank. So for them, it's not the right time to do the reflection on their own work.
Is your union in solidarity with, as you mentioned, the killed journalists in Gaza? Do they care about journalists from the other side?
Yes, we issued some statements when they target killed journalists. Not enough, in my view, but yes, we did.
What's the situation by the public or some mainstream journalists? Do they, you know, think that's like, oh, you're traitors and you're on
this? Yes, yeah. Yes, we were severely attacked for siding with Hamas. The automatic pilot say that every Palestinian male is a Hamas operator, including journalists. Actually, in the last few days, Hamas is publishing the names of their operators, militant operators in Gaza. And until now, they published names of, I think, four journalists who everybody thought are journalists, and they turned to be militants of Hamas, members of Hamas. Even the Committee to Protect Journalists, who is analyzing all the death of journalists in the world, and including Gaza, said that they should revise their analysis due to what Hamas was publishing. So I don't know. I don't think that all the 200 journalists that were killed in Gaza were Hamas militants or Hamas members, but we'll see what Hamas will publish. So some of them are probably militants of Hamas, members of Hamas.
Does that matter? Like when you work, you take footage, show the war, does it matter that you're, you know, when you do some kind of journalism, does it matter that you also are, you know, in favor of Hamas?
No, it's not in favor of Hamas. It's
that you work for them as in some kind.
Does it matter if when you do a kind of a journalist work and you are actually working for PR? Of course it does. Mm-hmm. Can you both work for a commercial organization and be an impartial, balanced journalist? No.
No.
There you go.
Can you work as an Israeli journalist while also being a reservist? Because like the other side is...
Same thing.
Because the other side is always like, okay, well, there are Israeli journalists who were also in the IDF, so they are IDF reservists. What's the difference? Is it legitimate criticism?
First of all, it's legitimate. I mean, it's an argument that and debate that should be happening. Mm-hmm. I think the difference is that, first of all, Hamas is not a state.
No.
Hamas is defined by most of the countries as a terrorist organization. Hamas doesn't make the difference between civilians and militants, soldiers, whatever. They killed babies, etc. Not that Israel didn't kill babies, but I tend to think that it was not done intentionally. It would be very hard for me as an Israeli to think that my country killed babies intentionally.
There was some Danish reporting, bullets and babies' heads. Did you see this a few weeks ago?
No.
Which kind of suggested that it was deliberate shooting of kids.
There was one that I think there was a film that made it to the Oscars, maybe, of a child. Recording of a child on the phone where the convoy where her car was part of and her family was not target killed but wounded in a shooting by Israelis, and she was crying for help, and help didn't come, and they shot again the same cars. I don't know. I guess here and there, yes, but not as a method. This was not a systemic thing to kill babies. So I think there is a difference between, you know, an organized army with a chain of commands and values. Not everybody keeps the values, but at least there is a code of ethics.
There should be a different standard for, you know, terrorist organization and a democratic government.
Yes, indeed.
We talked about military censorship. What about self-censorship with Israeli journalists?
So military censorship, this is something that we are under since the creation of the war of the state, because this is always a high security alert, always. In terms of self-censorship, yes. I think that the fact that they did not cover what's going on in Gaza is self-censorship. They didn't want to expose themselves to criticism by the audience, to a very, very, how would I define it, a hostile government, who, when they took office before the war, in December 22, they had a master plan to weaken the free press in the country, and they are doing it as we speak.
Really?
Yes.
You mean Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, or the entire government?
No, no, no. Prime Minister Netanyahu is now indicted. Mm-hmm. He has a trial for trying to manipulate the coverage of him in two, which were the two strongest and most distributed media in Israel at the time. So he's known for being obsessed with how he's being covered. There is a tsunami of legislation in the Knesset, in the parliament, to weaken the public broadcaster, to shut it down, to close only the news division, things like that, as we speak. Now they are discussing it in the Knesset. There is another legislation that targets the commercial television, creates chaos at the commercial television, all the regulations and everything, so they can, you know, have a political takeover. They decided to shut down the military radio, which is the public radio, to shut it down. It's waiting for the Supreme Court ruling. We filed a petition to the Supreme Court. They made a political takeover of the regulators for the commercial television. They tried to make a political takeover of Channel 13 news.
I mean, they try and try, but are they going to be successful, you think?
Some of these attempts are waiting for the ruling of the Supreme Court. Yes, they did that. Mm. They nominated politicians as the regulator for the commercial television. Mm. And we filed a petition to the Supreme Court, and now the Supreme Court has to decide whether to, yeah, right now they froze the decision of the government.
Does the Israeli public care about it? Are they being informed by the free media about these undemocratic attempts?
Too little, to my view, but they are informed. They don't understand, they don't deeply understand what it means for them as, you know, individuals. Yeah. They don't understand what it would look like if we don't have free press in the country. I mean, it would be like Turkey, Poland, Hungary.
Gaza,
yes. They would know what's happening. There is one minister who sued Channel 12 for investigative journalist piece for 12 million shekels. Yes, he's very rich. He can pay the, you know, the fee for the suit, 12 million. He also established a fund for everybody who wants to sue them. There is an organized and orchestrated smear campaign on social media against journalist media outlets. Prime Minister Netanyahu did not give an interview in Hebrew, journalist interview in Hebrew, since March 21.
No.
Yes.
I see him on American TV all the time.
Endless interviews in foreign media outlets.
What?
Not even one, a journalist, not for his, you know, he gave an interview to the only media outlet that completely aligns with the government and engaged in spreading conspiracy theories and lies. And the interview was conducted by his advisor.
You're kidding.
Like a spokesperson of him, yes. This was not an interview. He hardly opens a press conference for questions. And when journalists ask questions, he uses it to humiliate them. You're a liar. You're biased. You all lie all the time. I don't want to answer that. You know, just to create mistrust. And same thing as Trump, to create mistrust in the media. And there are proxies in the streets that chase journalists, block their cars, intimidate them in their homes, and they are encouraged by the Minister of Justice, who was having posted a short video encouraging one of these, you know, people, and telling him to continue, and by Minister of National Security, who happens to be Ben-Gvir, and they are most welcome in the Knesset, and they are well-respected in the Knesset committees. And this is what journalists have to face. So self-censorship is a way to protect themselves. You know, they don't want to get into this minefield and be...
They also have to protect the democracy.
So it really is a dilemma. How to do that when you are targeted by this poisoning machine orchestrated by Prime Minister Netanyahu himself. The same thing happened in Hungary. We see that now because what Magyar was doing was, you know, bypassing the mainstream media because the mainstream media was completely taken by Orban. I hope this will not happen here. We really tried to flash all the red lights that we could and ring all the bells that we could. And they understand now that this is something orchestrated against all of them. They're not targeting the public broadcaster because they're not nice. They're targeting all the free press in the country.
Two more questions. What's the situation for Palestinian Israeli journalists? Do they have a voice in Israeli media? Are they being heard? Do they self-censor as well?
They hardly have voice. Their situation in terms of freedom of expression is very bad. Many Israeli Palestinians were arrested for posting things, very mild things, on their social media accounts. They are much weaker than the Hebrew-speaking journalists. They are hardly seen on, you know, on television. You hardly see speakers coming from the Palestinian community in Israel. 21% of the Israeli public is, the Israeli society is Palestinian Israelis. 21%. This is a huge majority, minority. Huge. You hardly see them. Hardly. Unfortunately, not even before this October 7th, it was hard. Now they feel this is part of the self-censorship. They feel that the public is not ready to see Palestinian Israelis because they are considered to be, I don't know, Hamas supporters or something like that, which is completely lie.
And finally, how did you view the latest war with Iran? Because in Germany, we heard like when Iran attacked Israel, there was even more censorship than before. Was it true that it was not allowed to, you know, show footage of, you know, rockets hitting Israel?
Yes. First of all, this house was damaged because a missile fell not far away from it. All these windows were broken.
A few weeks ago.
On February 28th, when this war began, yes, everything. I mean, all the neighborhood, a huge radius, was damaged
severely.
Did any people get hurt?
No. One was killed. near the building where the missile hit. It was a missile, you know, like, I don't know, half a ton or something like that, very heavy, a lot of explosives. So the whole neighborhood, I mean, all the windows were broken. Yes.
Were you allowed to report on it?
Oh, yes, of course. Okay. Of course. No, no. I could report. What they didn't want to show, and I understand that, they didn't want to help the Iranians target better because they wanted to target strategic locations in Israel. So they didn't want to show live views of the where the missile hit. So the Iranians would not be able to, you know, target the place that to understand that it was 200 meters away from the place that they wanted to target, you know, because they wanted to target a military base. There is a military base here in the neighborhood. So maybe they were targeting military base and they missed it a little bit. So I understand that in terms of operations. So they wanted to protect. That's okay. I mean, for a short while, you don't want to show... You know, the journalists wanted to show the Haifa Harbor live because it's a beautiful location and it's a beautiful frame. But there is the refineries of the oil refineries that were hit in the previous war with Iran. So they didn't want to show the Iranians a live view of the Haifa Bay so they can better target the refineries or the harbors, things like that. This I can understand.
Sure. Hi, Tyler hier, Producer von Jung und Naiv. Ohne euch gibt's uns nicht. Jeder Euro zählt und ab 20 landet ihr als Produzenten im Abspann auf YouTube. Weiter geht's.
But it also reminds me of the live streaming of Gaza, because like there were live streams of, you know, the Israeli side watching Gaza burn or getting hit.
Yeah, AP had a camera there on the hill of Sderot, I mean, right on the border of Gaza, and they have a beautiful show of beautiful. Yeah, it was war, but yeah.
Anna, thank you so much. We didn't have a lot of time. Let's do this again at some point. One quick question, since you are also a peace activist, do you think you will ever, you know, experience peace between, you know, Israelis, Palestinians, and this region?
You know, in the last few months, the duration of the war and the intensity of the war, the wars, I get to maybe realize that I will not see the end of this film in my life. I don't know. The situation is so dire.
And you're still young.
Sorry?
You're still young.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. I hope so.
Well, you're young and naive. That's good. Thank you so much, Anand.
Thank you.
And see you soon.
Bye.